This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. I am Don Soa. Thanks for tuning in. Getting close to the end of this week, moving through, well, what is an important month here? And it's an important month not simply because it's the start of the second quarter of the year, but it's also at this point, we're at the very beginning of earnings season. So we get to get a close look at how, well, not just how well companies have done so far as the year progressed, but also to give you some sense of a report card on the analysts and the so-called Wall Street professionals who gather all the data every quarter, and some of that data, in fairness, is provided to them by the participating companies. These are all publicly traded companies. The earnings that you hear reported will typically be the top 500 companies in the U.S., which is the S&P 500, and it's reported to us in alphabetical order. And it's analyzed in a lot of different ways, but the bottom line is they're saying, okay, there's top-line earnings. That is, what do companies actually earn? What is gross revenue coming in the door? Now, that number is critically important because it gives you some sense of cash flows, the actual cash flows that a company's goods and services are earning for the company. Now, I say it that way because there's also bottom-line earnings, and net earnings, another word for a phrase for that, is what is the earnings of the company after they've subtracted out a series of factors, which is their overhead costs, and a number of other issues. We want to find out how much is this company actually earning per share. So there's a lot of things that come out of that, but companies can have their bottom line earnings looking very good. They can either meet or beat analyst estimates based on that number, but that could have a lot to do with layoffs, in other words, reducing the costs of operation for the company. Gross earnings are the revenue being earned, but, you know, the net revenue or the net profit of a company can also be driven by or improved by the way in which internal expenses are measured on one hand, but also controlled on another, and that sometimes means cutting costs dramatically. I would want to know, I think, as most analysts do, what the top-line revenue, which shows how successful the company's being with their products as well as their marketing, and how competitive are they versus other companies within their own sector, but also the bottom line, which is just how well-managed is the corporation internally. How do they handle their expenses? How do they handle distribution costs, payroll costs, and a whole series of other things? Yes, those are critically important numbers also, because when we talk about the price-to-earnings ratio of a company, which is a metric determining whether the stock is expensive or not, now it's expensive. How expensive it is probably most relevant when you're comparing it to other numbers, other companies' equivalent numbers, as well as what kind of expenses and efficient net revenue is a company generating compared to previous periods. So are we seeing a trend within the company showing improvements in their management of their internal costs, as well as are we seeing an improvement in new revenue coming in? What is their, and they'll compare it on a, say, it's depending upon the nature of the business, a store-to-store basis. They may be looking to see whether companies has taken on a new company, new product lines, or even bought out another company. We want to find out at what point a purchase of a new business may be accretive to the earnings of a company. At what point does that purchase of a new company actually create profitability for the company, a profitability above and beyond the initial costs? Well, that all said, the second quarter, these numbers that we're seeing now give us a little bit of a snapshot of what's happening here in the first quarter of 2017. Now, among the other unique things that will be, I think, listed carefully as part of this information gathering is, remember, the numbers we had at the beginning of the first quarter were simply reflecting what things look like in the fourth quarter of 2016. And, of course, they would look at entire year's numbers at that point, which is also helpful. But here we are now. We have a new president, don't we? We have a new administration. We have a new control structure, new leadership in Congress, the Senate, the House, in many ways. And, of course, we have a view of whether or not the executive branch of government has the ability to operate under the constraints of government. A corporate CEO, Donald J. Trump, is now the president of the United States. He is the head man, the key guy, not only in the White House, but in the entire executive branch of government. And the executive branch of government, at its best, is a very, very large entity. By most standards, larger than most corporations in any way, and certainly in terms of importance, more important than most corporations could claim to be. But it's also an entity that must work at its least and best, work with the House and the Senate, and do so under the auspices of the rules, the laws, which is, of course, determined or at least adjudicated by another branch of government we call the judiciary. And what this president is learning now, and I've heard a number of comments from people who are both antagonists of the administration as well as supporters of the administration, and they've talked about the word linkage. The linkage, that's the fact that one decision you make, one element that you support as president or as the executive branch, one element seldom works on its own without being connected in some way to other elements of government. The president learned, probably much to his chagrin, that the deal to cut the fluff and the extra cost out of the healthcare sector, which is 20% of our U.S. economy, he thought that, well, keeping people happy, understanding the politics of it, he said, well, let's repeal and replace Obamacare. Looking closely at what the president has done and said and listening to some of the advisors behind him and around him, I pretty much come to the conclusion that I could be wrong, certainly, and we'll find out. But from what we have seen and all of the seemingly endless reading that I've been doing on this subject, trying to learn more about it myself, is that the president doesn't really believe in repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act. There are key elements of the Affordable Care Act that he actually believes in and supports, and probably has come to the understanding that a great many of his supporters also support. So it's not enough just simply slap out and try to disassemble everything that the previous president of the United States did for the last 8 years, but instead to say, which I kind of like the idea of, that this president is suddenly sitting back and saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'm going to look at this plan, look at it much more closely than we did during the campaign, and no longer try to be political about it, but actually say instead, we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We're going to look at all of the elements of the plan that actually work. Let's look at the elements of the plan that don't work really, really well so far, but are very, very important to the American people and to our healthcare system. There's a lot of good things in the plan, along with a lot of junk, a lot of things that even the President Obama would admit need to be reformed, need to be changed, need to be improved. I think both the outgoing and new incoming administration understand that the system, the healthcare system, is too expensive. It's not fair along a great many lines. It doesn't give the consumer the level of control that most of us want in elements of our lives that we spend so much money on. And we want to bring that cost of getting at least what you might refer to as an acceptable level of care. There is a standard minimum level of acceptable care for the people of the United States of America. And I think this president believes that, and I believe it too. But he also has to realize that there are people on the ultra-left progressives who simply want health care to be a right of the American people, regardless of whether you have the ability to support the cost of it in any way, shape, or form. And, of course, they want everything free. They also typically want education the same way. Things are not privileges, they are opportunities, they are rights. That's problematic when you realize that when you establish something to be a right, someone is paying for it. And it's someone who is paying for it using dollars that they probably have earned through their own lifetime of hard work, or their new adaptation of work, you know, if they're new folks in the workforce. But there are a lot of people out there who, because they took risks, because they worked hard, because they've enjoyed some level of financial success, there's a issue of whether it's actually fair to them that they should be required to give up a great deal of what they have earned in order to support, entitlements for people who have not earned those entitlements. Now, by the same token, I do believe as a wealthy nation and as one of, in my opinion, best countries in the world with the finest people in the world, which is what I believe the American people are, that doesn't mean there aren't great people everywhere else, but I'm a great believer in America. I think it's unbelievable. I think it's already a great country. I think what we have to do is we want to be ultimately a very, very efficient country. And whether this presidency and this administration is going to be successful, at very least in the short term, and we're going to cut some slack here for the president, in the short term, there's a lot of concern about how fast and how successful the president could be with some of his key legislative agenda items. We'll talk about some of that, and we'll look at how the market is reacting in the long and short term right here at the beginning of the year. As investors look, people who vote with their money, what do they think of what's happening in Washington, D.C.? I'm Don Sowa. You're listening to AM 790, your home of talk and business. We'll be right back with more Money Talk, so please stick around. We're back with the Money Talk program, everybody. This is Don Sowa. Thanks for tuning in to AM 790, your home of talk and business. Stocks, well, lousy day yesterday, fabulous day the day before. My guess is going to be, at least for a while, until we get a sense of what the long-term and stable direction of government will be. Here's what's happened. Since 2008, early 2009, This economy and this market has been driven essentially by monetary policy. You've had the Federal Reserve engaged in an ongoing process of stimulus called quantitative easing. They had three cycles of it, QE1, QE2, and QE3. In all of these cycles, what they basically did was they went in and bought financial assets such as U.S. Treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. They did it in the open market. What that ultimately did was created demand, rather substantial demand, for these financial instruments. And that, of course, pushed the value of bonds in general. And that moved the entire bond market higher. Now, when the value of bonds are rising, then the fixed rate of their dividend, which is going to be paid out as a fixed dollar amount, but as a percentage of the value of the bond, if the bond value is rising, then the interest rate, or the yield, as we call it, is going to come down. It's a reciprocal relationship. It's just math, but it's a reciprocal relationship. And that means that new bond instruments, new issues coming out, are going to come out with lower yields. Now, what that essentially does is it makes money cheaper. It makes the rates on mortgages lower. Same is true for the prime rate and other rates that affect credit cards and car loans and other types of qualified and non-qualified debt. In other words, the cost of money is lower. Even corporations that are out there who decide they want to buy back some of their own stock for strategic reasons. Remember, if a corporation goes out and buys back several million shares of their own stock, that money, oftentimes that stock becomes what we call treasury shares. In other words, it's put into the treasury of the corporation. It's like sticking those shares in the vault. Those shares are no longer available to be traded in the open market. What that ultimately means is that the value of the underlying shares that are out there that are tradable are going to now reflect the value of the company based on bricks and mortar, market share, book value, and discounted cash flows. That means share prices rise. That's one of the reasons, one of the things that a company can do to oftentimes improve the value of their stock or the price of their stock shares is to buy back their own shares. Now, they can take money that they have available in their own, on their own balance sheet if they choose, But that money could be invested in different ways to promote business, to grow the business in general. If they have other debt out there, it could be used to relieve the company of that debt. They can surrender that debt through, through a rollover process or just to get rid of it. But that money also may be more valuable in terms of opportunity value going forward. So what does a company do? Well, if all of a sudden the cost of money, which is the cost to the, for them to go to the bond market or to the banks themselves, if the cost of money is coming down, then it's cheaper for them just to borrow the money and use the borrowed money to buy back their own shares. Now, if they also have cash on their balance sheet in other categories, maybe cash equivalents as we call it, and they decide later on it is advantageous to pay down that debt service. In other words, they borrowed the money to buy back the shares. Well, they can pay back that money in the future if they choose to. But ultimately, in the end, the fact that they're out there doing what they're doing is going to drive the markets further. Now, the other thing, too, is as interest rates come down and the dividend yields come down on bonds and other debt-related instruments, then all of a sudden the dividend yields that are out there and available on stocks, whether they're preferred stocks or common stocks, as those rates become more and more attractive, then a lot of investors are saying, you know, I'm willing to take a little bit more risk and participate in the stock market at this level. Stock prices seem to be pushing higher because investors are buying the stocks in the open market. They're taking a risk-on approach to investing because they're also getting a higher dividend. I mean, I look at some portfolios right now where if you look at the average dividend yield on the entire portfolio, a typical moderate portfolio today that could be anywhere from, say, one-third bonds and two-thirds stocks, or 60-40, or perhaps even 50-50, 50% bonds, 50% equities. We're looking at portfolios like that that are paying out 2.6 to 3%. Where even the U.S. 10-year Treasury right now is paying about 2.2, and a 30-year Treasury is paying under 4%. If we can get a possible stock potential growth return, as well as a comparable dividend yield from the equities markets, all of a sudden the equities markets look more attractive. Investors are more inclined to buy into it, and yes, accept that little bit of extra risk that's there. But wouldn't it be cool if, in fact, they pick up maybe 2 or 3% in capital appreciation? In other words, the share price is rising for demand purposes or whatever. 3% on the capital appreciation side and perhaps another 2.5% to 3% on the dividend side. Now the total return of that portfolio is now going to be 6% in the stock. If they can do that, especially if the companies are fairly blue-chip oriented, big companies, highly rated, AA, AAA in some cases, why would they bother to get a lower potential gross return or total return in the bond market? Even though the bond market may offer over time, on average, in retrospect, a lower level of volatility, it may not be all that dramatically lower. You have to wait and see. People sometimes cannot get the past out of their minds. And the individuals I've talked to, both here on the Money Talk program and in private, as well as in our own private practice, will sometimes say, well, you know, I'm still a little more conservative than I might normally be because of what we experienced back in 2008. Well, we went into a recession in 07 and 08. You had the global markets effectively melting down and credit markets freezing up where banks and other institutions were not lending money into the financial markets, even down to Main Street level. Small businesses couldn't get cash flow. They could not get their lines of credit were being frozen temporarily by institutions that they had been doing business with for many, many, many years. We saw it happen. I'm a small business owner myself. Our firm, uses institutional money on a number of levels. We saw what was happening, especially to clients of ours who are small business owners. They said, I can't believe it. I've been doing business with that bank or that credit union for, 15 or 20 years, and they're now telling me that they're not going to support the line of credit that we have used for the last 15 years. It's a tough decision. It's based upon risk management internally, But it's based upon the fact that many of these small to mid-sized institutions locally were not getting the financial support, or they didn't believe they could get the financial support from larger institutions or the government under the current economic situation. So the government stepped in. They required a great many institutions to take government money. They actually called it, they used the term bailout. But a great many of the big banks didn't even want the money. But the government gave it to them for one reason, because it was through the big banks that they were able to funnel the capital down to Main Street. The government didn't have the infrastructure, the resources to actually disseminate and distribute all that cash down to the areas where it was needed. Many banks and savings and loans and credit unions already had that infrastructure in place. They, in many cases, already had the relationships in place. They simply had to let their potential customers know that there was money available. So we go through cycles. We go through periods of time. But even coming off of that, there were people, I mean, they heard the worst of all possible situations. They would say, oh, no, my 401k is now a 201k. Well, that would mean you lost half the value of your account as an investor. And I've heard the commercials that try to scare the hell out of you and get you to go with their plan or their strategy, which, of course, is much, much safer, right? Well, the problem with that is that very few – I don't actually personally know anyone who lost half of their money. And I'm not talking about just our clients. I'm talking about people that I've talked to all over southern New England and even the country. Nobody lost that kind of money. I do know a couple of people I heard about that lost 44%, but they were very aggressively invested 100% in stocks. Well, how many of you out there would by choice be invested 100% in stocks? As an advisor here on the radio and certainly in private practice, I wouldn't allow a client to do that. I would make sure a client's allocation is consistent with who they are, what their risk tolerance is, and most importantly, what their needs and the timing of the needs of that money should be. That will determine how liquid, how relatively stable and safe those resources are, and quite frankly, what realistic rate of return you should be shooting for. It's all about you, folks. It's not about what some guy on the radio or TV has to say. We're going to take a quick break here on the Money Talk program. You are listening to AM 790. It's the home of talking business here in Southern New England, and I'm Don Soa. Thanks for tuning in. I'll be right back. And we're back with the Money Talk program. It's the second half of the show. Glad to welcome you if you're just joining us. Well, they just mentioned during their commentary that the Dow did finish up about 174 points today. Yesterday it was down over 100 points yesterday, but the day before that up about 180. It shows you how fickle the market can be on a daily basis. But the market is desperately looking for reasons to go in one direction or another. This sort of environment where you see this sort of day-to-day or intraday volatility is you know, it's commonplace during periods where the market has reached all-time highs, which we certainly have, but also periods where, based upon a series of valuation metrics, where the market is considered to be either fully valued or even overvalued. My personal inclination, and having talked to a number of different economists and market specialists, is that the market is right now at pretty close to fair or fully valued. Now, what that really means is that based upon current economic conditions, in other words, the data that we've gotten out over the last several months since the beginning of the year, that based upon those considerations, that the current pricing of stocks that make up this market reflect what the pricing should in fact be. So fair value, fully valued. That means the stock price builds in an expectation of what is actually happening right now. Now, what's also happening right now, so to speak, and I mentioned this at the beginning of the show, is that the analysts are now getting affirmation. In other words, they're getting the real numbers from corporate America. The top 500 companies in the U.S., the largest, are announcing their actual quarterly earnings for the first quarter of 2017. Now, all of these people that they're technically talking to, yes, they're talking to all of us who are investors, but they're also talking to the analytical community. The analysts on Wall Street have projected or predicted what the company's earnings would be for this quarter, for this 90-day period since the beginning of January. They also use data provided to them upon request by the financial offices, the chief financial officers, and the financial analysts who track most of these companies directly. The S&P 500 companies are what they call highly efficient large blue chip companies. Blue chip meaning, well, that's just sort of a metaphor for the most valuable chip in your hand if you're playing poker with chips, of course. But ultimately, it's big, big, big companies, large cap value companies. Most companies that make up the S&P 500 will also pay a dividend. So they don't have to buy some charter or contract, but they typically do. So these are large cap value companies. Not pure value in so much as a value manager typically tries to find stocks that are trading, that are currently trading at levels that are below what the companies are really worth. They will look at the cash flow of the company. They'll look at its bricks and its mortar and its business lines and a whole series of other things that determine value. And they'll say, well, wait a minute, this is a $50 stock based upon the number of outstanding shares available to investors. That this is what the company's actually worth. It's book value. And they look at the price and they say, well, wait a minute, if the stock is priced at 38 to 40, if that's what it's trading at in the open market, then it's, you know, it's worth 50 or more, then we feel it is underpriced, undervalued. And oftentimes a value management or a mutual fund, for example, uses a screening process that says, let's pick a list of all companies we can find, say, in the largest 1,000 companies in the trading market in the U.S., for example, and screen out the ones that are currently trading based on our records and our analysis are trading at, say, upwards of 20% below book value. So if a stock is a $50 stock trading at 38, it's going to show up on the list. Now, this gives the management team an opportunity to go in and say, hey, let's find out why it's trading below fair value. Maybe there is a reason that it should be trading below value, despite what we thought. But if they find out that it's just a short-sighted issue and there's something going on that's unfair to the company and it hasn't been built into the market price yet, that's what that manager is going to say. Let's put our buy recommendation or put it high on our list of potential buys. That's what investors like to do. But when you're in an environment like we're in right now, where the price-to-earnings ratio historically is in the, say, the 15 or 16 range, 15 to 17, price of a stock divided by its earnings comes up with a P.E. ratio. If the P.E. is 16, it means that essentially, because you're taking the price of a stock per share divided by its earnings per share and come and say, hey, it costs us this much to buy $1 of earnings at that company. So 16 is the number we're talking about. Now, 15 to 17 might be the long-term average that the market trades at historically. And here we are now. We could be trading anywhere from, say, 18 to 20. Now, interestingly, 18 to 20 is higher, certainly, than the long-term average. But that doesn't mean it's not justified. We have very, very low interest rates that the market is trading at, and comparable rates for fixed income investments like bonds are also historically low still. Even though mortgage rates have been slowly inching higher, they're still at historically low levels. So all of a sudden a stock can handle a slightly higher price-to-earnings ratio because of slightly higher dividend income payments the stock may be generating, but also the value of that stock compared to comparable investments in the bond market, which have been based on very fairly low yields. So this may be a reasonable level. Now, it does mean, in fairness, that there's no easy pickings. The low-hanging fruit has already been picked, another metaphor we use, an analogy. But at the same time, if surprises occur in the sector that a stock trades in, like the energy sector, or perhaps the healthcare or financial services sector, if individual companies or even the sector itself has some surprises, then we may be able to justify higher prices than what they're trading at. So fair value means it's not as easy to pick. But at times where where the market is trading at fair value, this may be the occasion where we as analysts or we as the people who are go-betweens between the investment world on Wall Street and individual clients and consumers, that's the field that I'm in, and Steve Bovee and Donna Allard, the three of us are certified financial planners. This is the world we're in, and we are that intermediary between the consumer or the customer or the client and the world that manages the money directly, mutual funds, exchange-traded funds, indexes, and, of course, individual companies as well. And we, as intermediaries, can look at companies or can look at funds or sectors and say, there are things happening here that are not being priced into the market. If the market is at fair value, maybe it's time for us to look at some of the more active managers in certain areas, not in all, but in certain areas. We talked about this on the Money Talk program on Tuesday with Donna Allard. Get back to basics. Talk about the difference between an active manager and a mutual fund and an index or perhaps an exchange-traded fund, which are also indices. And a computer model that's based upon an index that's run by computer without the benefit of active feet, shall we say, boots on the ground kind of people out there kicking the tires, looking at the credit worthiness of companies, looking at opportunities building or developing in and around a certain company or a certain sector. These are all issues that the computer may not be building into its formulas or its algorithms, but individual teams of researchers, teams of analysts, as well as skilled, qualified managers, they may be able to take advantage of what we refer to as the inefficiencies of the market. In other words, there's things happening out there that may not be commonplace and may not be known by everyone looking at a particular company. A highly efficient market is a market where there is a lot of information about all the companies that make up that market or that sector, and it's available to everyone. If that's the case, inexpensive and easy access to all that information, then you don't have the need for a tremendous amount of wisdom to know which of those companies to avoid and which of them to embrace. That's what the active manager does, makes decisions on what to buy, at what price, and what the timing of that purchase, or the timing of the more difficult decision, which is the sale, when do I get out of a stock, that's what these people do for a living. Now, in fairness to the indexes, and we've mentioned this many times, is there are a great many portfolios that I would create in an effort to keep expenses lower as well, where the core positions in the portfolio, which sometimes are as much as a half of the stock positions in a portfolio, may be in the category of core positions. If I could find really well-designed and low-cost exchange-traded funds, or ETFs, which are index funds unto themselves, some of them are highly specialized and highly focused index funds, not going to carry 500 stocks in them, in other words. Some of them carry as few as 18 to 25 stocks, again, depending on the focus. But it represents a representative basket of stocks within a key sector of the market, a key index representative. And determining what gets bought or sold within an index is going to be driven by usually by computer programs. So the cost should be low. If we can bring those costs down, they're traded as no-load funds primarily. If there's transaction costs, they have institutional pricing, which is lower. Well, that's a wonderful place to be in big, big blue-chip core positions, which may not differ dramatically. And remember, you've heard them say, you've heard the adages, gentlemen who are namesakes out there like Jack Bogle at Vanguard. He said many times, he'll say that, you know, most active managers, only 30% of the time or 30% of the managers will outperform the index that they use as their benchmark. Well, I get that. But it's during periods like the ones actually we're in right now where you have markets at fair value, when you're trying to build your satellite positions around that core of indexes, those satellite positions probably are going to be with active managers, and you as an investor are going to pay a little bit more money for the internal cost of that active management. But sometimes that's important. What we're looking for is people giving value added or alpha. Those managers better be generating something different, something extra, because if they want us to pay them, and pay them a little bit more, then they better be giving a little bit more. So you'd be seeking out that 30% of managers or the 30% of the time where they can outperform the index. Folks, I'm Don Sower. You're listening to the Money Talk program on AM 790. Stick around. I'll be right back.
That's 800-457-8287. 800-457-8287. We'll be right back.
And we're back with the Money Talk program, everybody. You know, it's funny, this time of year, there's a lot you really need to understand, at least at the fundamentals, which is one of the reasons we do a Tuesday Get Back to Basics program here on AM 790 for Money Talk. But you look at particular indexes, like the S&P 500, today was up 0.75%. Now, the Dow Jones had a great day today and a lousy day yesterday. It's going to be driven and more affected by the movement of individual companies than the larger exchange like the S&P or even the NASDAQ, which could have hundreds of different companies. NASDAQ, tech heavy, not too many dividend paying assets in there, but it's up. It was up nearly 1% today, which is a big deal. But now, even in the area of specific area, specific markets, the S&P 500 is made up of basically, yes, 500 companies, but representing 10 different sectors. In sectors like financials, in industrials, in the materials sector, each of them rose about 1% today. And that was enough to pull the entire index up about 0.75. Now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is going to be more volatile. And you have to be aware of that, especially on individual days where news is coming out, especially during earnings season. All you need is a couple of companies within the Dow that trade on the Dow. There's only 30 companies. So you could have one company have an overweighted effect on the performance of the Dow as an index. And corporate America's hanging in there, despite some of the economic data not being overly impressive, but not overly negative either. Verizon was the disaster, I guess, in this particular short-term market era. Verizon, which is a Dow member, missed its mark both on, remember I said at the beginning of the show, we're talking about earnings, which is top-line revenue, and the bottom line as well. So both earnings and revenue were a problem. The company attributed a 5.1% drop in their sales, which is top-line, to decreased overage revenue, lower postpaid customers in the quarter, as well as continued promotional activity, which means that they're spending a lot of money advertising and promoting their services, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I'd rather have reduced net profit because we're spending money promoting our business in hopes of future revenue growth than simply saying, oh, well, our number of customers spent less money than we expected. But on the other hand, it is only Verizon's only one of the 30 companies that trade on the Dow. Other ones, for example, the railway company CSX, it posted better than expected results up and down, top line and bottom line. And it actually expects its profits to jump 25% during the course of this year. That's an even more important number because investors are going to look at the price of CSX and say, well, geez, if they're correct and their profit jumps 25%, then we can justify a higher price for that stock. That's what makes investors buy. The stock rose more than 6% today to lead the Dow Transports. And the transportation index is critically important, whether it's the S&P Transport Index or the Dow Transport Index, critically important companies. It does deal with airlines and a few other categories of transportation also. But the reason it's so important is that sometimes it's a bellwether for what's happening in the overall domestic and global economy. Because products and services move around. They move around the world. They move around the country. And if there's a slowdown in the transportation of products and services, then, of course, that means business is slowing down. But transports did really, really well. It affected the indices across the board, and we ended up having a good day today. The S&P Regional Bank ETF, KRE, and the bank ETF, the regular bank ETF, KBE, they rose more than 1% today as well. Steel stocks also caught a bit of what I call a Trump bid. He said that he directed the Commerce Department to prioritize a probe on foreign steel products being flushed into the system, being dumped on domestic providers. That's the effect on, and to see what the effect could be on U.S. national security. Shares of U.S. Steel, as a result, surged more than 7% on the hope that this administration is going to be putting rules into effect, maybe tariffs, I don't know, some sort of border taxes, who knows. But more importantly, just looking at other countries that produces a steel and seeing if they're dumping into the U.S. market and doing what they have to do to fix that or to stop it. And that's what the industry likes to hear, and of course the analysts liked hearing that as well. There are just a bunch of little things adding up to today's rally, and we saw just a few of them and some of them. But remember, it's day-to-day. You have great days with upside rallies. Remember, today's Thursday. Tomorrow is another day. The markets will trade either up or down. It may have a lot to do with what somebody out of Washington says, or just more of the earnings numbers coming in and surprising analysts. Hey, folks, I'm Don Sowa. Tune in tomorrow at 5. Steve Bove will be here to close out the week on Money Talk. Have a good night.
Guys don't really talk about antiperspirant. Despite that, 91.